And Judy is my guest in the studio tonight, and she began playing the piano at the age of 10 in Auckland. And since arriving from New Zealand in 1960, she's become one of Australia's leading musical identities. She was on the El Rocco scene here in Sydney in the 1960s, while she enjoyed lengthy periods with the orchestras of all the major television networks. In 1973, she joined the jazz faculty at the Sydney Conservatorium. She's been awarded the Moe Award and the APRA Award, along with an OAM in 2004, for her services to music and education. She performed for the APEC leaders in 2007, and in July 2008, she was presented the Distinguished Services to Australian Music Award at the Sydney Opera House. In 2008, she was chosen as one of Sydney's top 100 most influential people in Fairfax's Sydney Morning Herald. Judy Bailey, that's probably the most lengthy introduction I've ever had to a guest on Now's the Time. So welcome.
Oh, thank you very much, Frank. It's good to be here.
Judy, sadly, the jazz world learned of the death of Graham Bell on the 13th of June.
Yes.
Fondly known as the father of Australian jazz. Can you share some of your lasting memories of Graham Bell with our listeners tonight?
Well, one memory which I just love is sitting down having a lovely chat with Graham one day, and he told me that he was, and this is when he was, this w would be like, when he was getting on, and he made a point of assuring me that not a day went by when he didn't play the piano, which is wonderful. And as far as I know, he kept playing the piano every day, right up until the end. But the thing that got to me was he said, "Do you know, Jude?" He said, "I never owned a grand piano until very late in life." And he said, "My dear wife Dorothy was the one that bought it for me." He said, "My whole musical world just took on a different shine altogether." Because, yes, I mean, for any pianist, upright pianos are fine, they certainly have their place. But a grand piano, it's a little bit like going from riding a bike to driving a Mercedes, I suppose.
Yes. Boy, oh boy, what a figure in Australian jazz
What
as
a
far as.
towering figure. Yes. Yes, indeed.
Judy, in my introduction, there was no mention of all the distinguished creative jazz and improvising artists that you've worked with over the years. Is there any one Australian figure that stands out for you out of all your career?
It would be very difficult for me to pinpoint just one figure, Frank, because there have been actually many. So I'd be a little bit shy about mentioning any particular names.
You mentioned John Sangster before,
When we were chatting,
off air,
yes.
and we were.
And Sandy Evans,
That's
of
right.
course.
Yes.
Yes.
There's been so many, hasn't
Oh, look,
there?
there have been. And for all different reasons and for all the right musical reasons, yes. There's, I think Australia has an incredible array of musical talent, and that's been evident for many years.
But what is it about New Zealand pianists, Judy?
Oh, that's an embarrassment of riches. I mean, there are so many of us over here. Oh, dear.
It is quite incredible, though, isn't
Yes, it
it?
is. It
When you
is.
think of Mike Nock and
Yeah.
Gerard Masters and well, the list
And
escapes me.
Steve Barry.
Steve Barry,
Yes.
that's
Oh, look,
right.
there really are so many of them. I think it's something to do with the milk.
What about your overarching influence on your piano style? Is there any one influence, and if not, how would you describe the Judy Bailey sound through the years on piano?
Oh gosh, you're asking me two very difficult questions, Frank. I thought this was going to be a very lovely, pleasant interview, but all these curly questions coming up. Look, honestly, again, I can't name any one individual. There have been so many marvelous musical influences, both in the classical and the jazz spheres. So it would be impossible for me to name the number of influences. The second part of your question regarding how would I describe the sound, I guess if I were to be asked to give an honest appraisal, I'd have to say, generally speaking, the music I play seems to be strongly melodic. I think I've always had a really good appreciation of harmony and how harmony needs to work, for me anyway. From a technical point of view, I don't think it's never been flash, what you would call inverted commas, flashy playing. You have to practice too hard to organise that.
The name Bill Evans comes to mind. Has that comparison ever been drawn as far as an influence is concerned?
There have been people along the way who have referred to Bill Evans playing. And I think probably he's had an influence on a number of players. I've appreciated his harmonic bent,
yes.
If I can put it that way. And it's always had a familiar ring to me. So.
In Australia in the past decade or so, we've seen some major initiatives, most specifically to enhance female participation in jazz, namely the SEMA Women's Workshops that they hold from year to year, the Jan Rutherford Memorial Award, up until a few years ago, I think the Melbourne Women's Jazz Festival has taken place. And of course, in Sydney here, the Sirens Big Band now is a big band just full of female instrumentalists. It could be argued that much of the trailblazing for women in jazz was done by one Judy Bailey. Your enthusiasm, your verve, your love for sharing your knowledge of the music, how do you feel about that idea? And do you feel you're an inspiration for female jazz artists that have chosen a career in jazz?
Well, to be honest, I've never thought of myself in that way. But since you put it that way, I would like to think that there are some aspects, at least, of the music that I produce, whether it's playing the piano or works that I've composed and orchestrated for orchestras or big bands or small groups or whatever. I would like to think that some people perhaps have appreciated what they've heard and maybe been able to gain something from it, something constructive that's helped along the way. But yeah, I don't know what else to say to that.
Because, Judy, in reality, jazz is such a male-dominated art form.
It has. But becoming less so, I think. Very.
So.
Look, the wheels turn very slowly. That all we can do is try and help the process along, try and oil those wheels a little.
Have you ever felt intimidated by that fact, or is it? Have you ever felt any disadvantage because it's been such a male-dominated art form?
Well, look, it's interesting that you put that to me because it's not the first time I've been asked that. Maybe it's because I've been so intent upon being involved with the music because I love it so much that perhaps, thankfully, I haven't even almost noticed the disparity in the ranks. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, yes.
So, I mean, if that's the reason, then I guess I've been lucky. Or maybe there's a hint of the ostrich syndrome. head in the sand.
That's
stuff.
Right. That's right.
Yeah, because when you're faced with a certain set of circumstances, I think in life sometimes rather than allow your life to be turned upside down through angsting over it, perhaps one needs to develop the art of what I call the art of ignore. I feel pretty strongly about the fact that music is music, and if gender comes into it, I fail to see the real relevance of that in the bigger picture of music for music's sake. Sadly, it's not just confined to music. There are so many issues where, and I don't need to spell it out because we all know what those issues are, where women seem to have taken second place for a very, very long time, and the wheels are still continuing to turn very slowly.
Yes.
But that's the nature of things. So we just get on with doing what we need to do, continuing to practice the art of ignore, knowing
yes.
that the imbalance eventually will redress itself. It's been said more than once by different people that no matter what area of endeavour you're involved with, generally speaking, if a woman, inverted commas, makes it, then they're generally twice as good as their male counterparts. That may or may not be the case, and I'm certain that probably most females feel they have to try harder to achieve a certain goal in male-dominated areas. But it's all part of the wheels turning slowly syndrome.
Yeah.
And we just have to get on with what we do. And if we love it enough and have a real passion for whatever it is that we do, then we're just going to pursue it no matter what. And it's interesting because I didn't choose it. It chose me.
Mm.
And I guess that that's true of most people when they have a real passion for something.
You've been a big part of the Jazz Connection Big Band. You instigated that initiative. Of course, a number of players through that band over the years have gone on to become successful artists in their own right.
Mm.
Can you describe that feeling of pride that you must have when a certain level of success comes to an ex-band member?
I sometimes, in my own mind, compare myself to a clucky hen. I just think it's fantastic when various players who have gone through the band really excel and become noticed in the wider area.
That's right. And you've been a talent scout as well. I mean, you've been able to recognise young students with talent that indeed have gone on.
Mm-hmm.
You would know the names better than me. Mm. Matt Baker comes to mind, but there are many others.
Are there not? Oh, indeed, there are. Yes.
You're being very humble with me tonight, Susan.
Oh, Frank. There are so many that have excelled, and I'm just so happy for them, you know?
Yes.
And some are overseas now, and there are others who are about to go overseas. Yes, it's wonderful.
The sounds of Ellington. For you, what differentiates his music from the gamut of other jazz composers?
Well, for a start, there's more of it.
He was prolific, wasn't he?
Oh, yes, he was. Yeah. And his music, I don't think you could ever say it was boring. It's so tuneful, full of little harmonic redirections where you don't expect them to go. And let's bear in mind that his right-hand man, Billy Strayhorn, should always be included on the credit list, I think.
Recognised for that, compositional input.
Mm. Yes, definitely. But his music has survived for so long, and it's still an integral part of the jazz repertoire for so many musicians worldwide.
And I think his influence crosses over to artists that don't necessarily come from the jazz world as well. Judy, let's talk about the jazz listening audience now. And from your historical perspective, how have you seen the jazz listener and how they've discerned the music? How has that changed over the period of your career, especially here in Australia?
Mm-hmm. Sadly, along with the discernment, the numbers have dropped. Yes, something that's becoming more a cerebral experience rather than a tap your feet to it experience. I don't see why we can't have both. Because, there are so many wonderful aspects to the entire spectrum of music making. Quite frankly, I'd become very bored if I were exposed to just one type of music making.
And, of course, your music has crossed all of those boundaries, hasn't it?
Hopefully, yes.
In recent years, you've sought to bridge the gap between jazz and classical music.
Yes.
Have you felt that jazz was lacking a certain legitimacy that classical music has always enjoyed?
Well, it's interesting that you bring that up. And funnily enough, it it reminds me of a conversation I was having with Graham Bell on a different occasion from the one I described before. Graham and I were talking about how it feels when you've had a classical training to begin with, and then you branch into jazz, which is what happened with me. So there's always been that very strong underlay of classicism with me. I think it's probably in my playing as well still, and in my writing. I remember on that occasion, Graham sort of wound up that conversation by saying, you know, if jazz had been popular, it would have died out long ago.
What a classic line.
Yeah, I know. Only Graham would come up with something like that. I think that there are so many wonderful aspects to all music, and in particular, I realize we're talking about the classical and the jazz genres now. But to me, there's always been that fascination with the challenge of endeavoring to integrate the two forms because they have so much in common. And also, something that's very dear to my heart is endeavouring to be involved in a situation that brings about, hopefully, a unity with classical and jazz musicians playing together. And so, a lot of the compositions that I've written for orchestras, for instance, have had that goal in mind to try and unify the two musical elements and the players themselves.
Now, it's always been a bit of a dilemma where you have the orchestra, who are generally not known for their expertise in being able to improvise, and then on the other side of the stage you have the jazz guys there filling their role in that particular. Do you ever see a situation where that can be more, I guess, genuinely melded?
A lot depends on the style of the composition and the type of conductor. Any interaction that is able to take place between the composer and the musicians. Often just a little spoken suggestion can make all the difference. Do you know, it nearly breaks my heart the number of times classical musicians have come up to me and said, "Gosh, we really wish we could improvise like you jazz people can." And there's only one answer to that, and which I give them, which is, "You can. You can improvise." And it's just being given, for a start, the permission to do
The
so, to say
opportunity.
then it's okay, it's allowed. You know, it's a lost art. Classical people were doing this way back, and it was an accepted part of how they functioned.
I wonder whether you could answer this, what point in time where that was actually lost to the classical artist, that notion of being able to improvise within the constraints of classical music as we know it.
Well, I think once the art of improvising the cadenza went out the window, then from then on, there was very little attempt to improvise. So many of the earlier composers, they basically composed on the spot through improvisation. And then, of course, they wrote their pieces. That's how it was done way back. But it's encouraging that so many classical players are interested in the art form. Conversely, it's interested me to see how many jazz people are starting to take such an interest in classical music. I think it's great.
Yes, and some of the ensembles that have popped up around town,
They reflect
and
this.
ensembles like Amphibious, Compass to a certain
Yes.
degree, a lot of the notated music is actually coming back into their sound.
That's right.
Yes,
It's
you're right.
interesting you mention Amphibious because Ollie Miller, the cellist, I had the privilege of giving Ollie his first jazz piano lessons.
Is that right?
Yeah, when he was in the high school at the Con.
Another example of what we were talking about before. Your Australiana suite. You're inspired by our landscape with titles from the movements of that suite, like a Red Desert, Walkabout, a White Waratah, Red Desert. Can you tell us a little bit about this?
It's fairly introspective. It happens to feature a fellow called Ross Harrington on the alto saxophone. And Ross has just recently gone overseas. He was one of the people that I mentioned before when I said some of them are overseas. He's got a bright, shining career ahead of him, both as a player and a writer.
Judy Bailey, thanks very much for joining us in the studio. It's been a pleasure.
Well, it's been my pleasure also. Thank you very much, Frank.